Good morning. Are there any questions? Neil and I have plenty to talk about, which we could just do, but I think it would be fair to you to start with, are there any questions? David. Was it, David, was it a Eucharist, his funeral?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm with you all the way. I would have been there waving flags and talking with your people about what a brilliant idea that was.
That was the last time I did.
Okay. Yeah, that was what I was afraid you were saying. What I'd say is, as I think it probably is clear to you, offering and offering language is historically neuralgic to Lutherans. But that doesn't mean to say, especially in North America, and increasingly in other places in the Lutheran world, even in the old Lutheran world, that collections are taken. In North America, we supported church and missions in other ways at the very beginning, but North American Lutherans quickly learned, like other people here, that this was a volunteer society, and we had to think about stewardship. And the whole stewardship thing then replaced things like pew rents and subscriptions and membership fees and all that stuff. But what's happened recently is an awareness that at the earliest beginnings, at some of the earliest beginnings of Christian worship, already in the second century and potentially even in the first century, the Christian assembly and collecting for the poor were profoundly linked. So Paul's polemic against in 1 Corinthians 11 against the way in which the Corinthian community is doing Eucharist, excluding the poorer or working members of the congregation from the meal, is not unrelated to Paul's interest in at the end of the first Corinthians letter and the fierce interest in Second Corinthians to the collection for the poor of Jerusalem, if you will. Now that's ambiguous about what that all means, but when we look at both Tertullian and Justin in the second century, the meal-holding assembly was profoundly related to the collecting for the poor. That's been recovered among us to such an extent that in the ELW you see it in the tone of the offertory prayers and of the prayers after communion. Lutherans are going to come to collecting and offering still with what Max Turian, the great theologian member of the community of Teze, called the crisis of the offertory. That is to say, we collect things as if we're giving it to God, and then we realize it's not. We can't get it across to God. We say, God, use this stuff for your mission, if you will. And what you wind up doing is giving it to your neighbor, if you will, or giving it to ministry that tries to serve your neighbor, tries to serve the world. Anyway, I've wound up saying, I don't think Eucharist should be celebrated without a collection. I think collection belongs so essentially to Eucharistic fraction. And I mean not a collection to pay the celebrant. I mean a collection for mission and the poor. So I was so glad we did that. We're doing that here. There's more to say about that. That's a huge topic in Lutheran liturgical thought, but that's the beginning. But Neil.
Just a couple of additions to that. I quite agree with Gordon in principle on that, and I too believe that a Eucharist without the opportunity for there to be a collection, and whether that means an actual liturgical collection or the opportunity to give and then that be presented at the gifts. One of the debates in the Episcopal Church, and the prayer book is intentionally unclear on this point because the framers of the book cannot agree. Because there's the one side that says, and this is about the gifts on the altar, should the money be on the altar with the bread and wine, or should it not? And this is a perennial fight in the Episcopal Church. And I know people who actually leave congregation. I have one colleague. If they pass the money off and do not leave it on the altar, he will leave the liturgy. Now I think that's a little excessive on his part. He needs to pray about that. But but at the same time, I take his point. Some say, well, no, we want to get the filthy lucre off the table so we can offer the bread and wine. And then the other side would say, no, wait, hold on here. The filthy lucre is the stuff of our life that we are offering to God that hopefully God is going to receive and consecrate and then we're going to give for the life of the world and our neighbor and whatever. So, but that, we could debate that one all afternoon. But the other thing, Gordon's line about that Lutherans tend to be more neuralgic about offertories, that's true. That's absolutely true. But the thing that I find interesting in comparing that with our sensibilities in the Episcopal Church is we opted not to do offertory prayers. Because and we let the ritual of actual making the offering carry that without, in some sense, inserting an offertory prayer, and that's a representative not so much of our neuralgia about offering, but about what the right thing to say at offering was. And we tried all manner of offertory prayers, and none of them ultimately made the prayer book. And the decision was made to, well, let's not say too much about that at that point. But it was for slightly different set of reasons. But I think it probably does share a little of that anxiety, but it manifests itself in a different way. The other thing that we've got to be really careful of, at that point, and you see this in any number of parishes where the offertory procession and the giving of the gifts are so much larger than what is coming. I remember one time, I'm sure the liturgy now has been graciously reformed there, but I remember one time I was a Sunday Eucharist at Trinity Wall Street, which doesn't have budget troubles, so when they came and when they offered the in the offertory procession they brought this marvelous tray of bread, and when it was received at the altar, the organist went da 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 da, and then when the wine came, it was da 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 da, and then when they raised up this huge alms basin full of money, it was da 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 da. I mean, and then when all that was over, the rector went, "The Lord be with you." And so this huge accelerando, to this extraordinary moment. And then when we got to the real thing, the bottom fell out, and that's less likely to happen in the Lutheran ritualization of it because you do have an offertory prayer. The offertory prayer, clears up the action at that point. So it's an interesting, just interesting the way we've handled that differently. But I quite agree. I think if you're going to have a Eucharist, you got to have an offertory. Other, Stuart, happy birthday.
Some of the folks that are on the ground combining liturgies, figuring out what works, what doesn't, and some of the hear your reflections on how we do that. Some of us are first half Lutheran, second half Episcopal. We're flipping back and forth by season. Some people are doing all Lutheran, all Pentecost, and all Episcopal, all Advent, or whatever. Thoughts, reflections on that, and doing justice one way or the
other. I just have a couple of immediate thoughts. And the first of those I learned as a bishop, and that is one size doesn't fit all in these matters, and that one really does have to pay attention in a thoughtful and prayerful and discerning way to the needs of the local community. And that's why I'm always anxious of directives that come out from synodical or diocesan or national offices about this is how you do this kind of thing. Because that may be just the right thing for downtown Minneapolis. But if you're in Yakima, Arkansas, it may not be the right thing. So I do think as a general principle, if you're alternating rites, then alternating probably by season or by some intelligible part of the annual cycle would initially make sense to me, though there may be reasons for that to vary, or maybe to say that a different way, there may be reasons for that to be punctuated. I'll give you an example, and this is completely unreflected. I may want to take all this back in a minute, but I think let's just say that the second half of the season after Pentecost is Episcopal time. And yet, right smack in the middle of that is Reformation Day, which, unless the Lutheran Church has changed a lot, and which I don't sense that it has, that's an important day. And so now that doesn't mean that season after Pentecost couldn't be an Episcopal season, so to speak. But we would want to be sensitive to that particular feast. In the fellowship with our Lutheran sisters and brothers. And there may be feasts of the Episcopal Church for which that is equally true during a particular feast of the church, particularly heartwarming to Anglicans. But again, I think to the greatest degree those things are part of local discernment. The challenge that seems to me that's interesting in that, though, I mean, I really do believe that we do better when we share with each other the full integrity of our rites rather than try to hybridize them. But then there's a challenge to what do we do on Christmas Eve? I think Gordon rightly pointed out that the Triduum liturgies are close enough for government work. You know, I mean, they've. You could pull those together without doing any serious ritual or damage to the other kind of thing. I think that's pretty clear. But what would you do on a time like Christmas Eve, where now that may be easier. I mean, for Episcopalians, that's generally a straightforward Eucharist with all the necessary music and ceremonial and whatever. Matter of fact, I'd be partially flippant and say, on Christmas Eve you could do whatever the Lutherans need to do it as long as you sing O Come All Ye Faithful at the beginning. but anyway, Gordon probably has some thoughts about this.
The major thing I want to say to you guys is thank you. Thanks for the work. Please let the churches know what you're doing and what you're finding out. I think it can be hugely important. And I think I've said this to you privately. I think probably your wisdom on this is greater than ours. But nonetheless, you asked the question, and I'll say a couple things. One, I would love it if you would in liturgical life. You're going to need to be in touch with the Episcopal bishop much more than you're going to need to be in touch with the Lutheran bishop. That I would love it if the Episcopal bishop would give you permission to regard right three, or to ignore the rubric about an order for Holy Eucharist not being available for Sunday use, and that you would set that side by side with pages 94 and 95 in the ELW, and do your planning on an order base. I don't think that has to. I mean, I'm sensitive to Neil's concern about hybridization, but I don't think I think the convergence in ordo thought about Christian worship in the present time is great enough that then the resources that are available to fill out that ordo could become remarkably shared sources. That's one hope I'd have. Here's another possibility. Get permission again from the ordinary to think seriously about using the Episcopal rite, but a Lutheran Eucharistic prayer, or using the Lutheran rite and a Eucharistic prayer from the Book of Common Prayer. That kind of hybrid, I don't think, is appalling. Then I guess a third, I'd say put your voices into the national Episcopal discussion in favor of prayer book reform or prayer book renewal, so that it gets beyond the discussion stage. And watch for the prayer book studies, or go to work on the prayer book studies yourself. And I profoundly hope that there will be really interesting things for all of us that come from that process in the Episcopal Church. That's what I think. Splendid.
I mean, it's exactly what
I'm really glad. Well, then, God be praised. I think that's your wisdom and my just guessing. But thank you. Yeah, good. Good. Great. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Ah.
So I'm wondering if that's just a misunderstanding that's out there, or if the Bishop Neil can comment on
that
change.
That's splendid. Neil's the man.
No, probably not. Ted, do you have any idea what he's talking about? Oh, the blogger cannons. Yes, I remember those. Yes. No. No, I think there's a confusion here. I actually, this is all coming back now. I believe I'm correct in saying that what the convention did is that it heretofore some of the supplemental rites, and we're not talking about the order for the Eucharist in the prayer book, except in the sense that it's that order that becomes the structure for which some of the supplemental rites are used. But the resolution specifically addressed that certain supplemental rites that heretofore were available for use in the church and even available for use on Sundays, but not for the principal service of the Lord's Day, which of course is a designation that has to be made locally. I mean, you know, somebody's got to say, is our principal service of the Lord's Day 8, 9, or 10? You know, the permission that was given was to take away the limitation on the use of the supplemental materials for the principal service on Sunday. That's not quite the same thing as saying that that the rubric on the order of worship has been suspended. Though I would be willing to admit, and we talked about it at least in the House of Bishops, that that may be to the same effect. But that's not exactly what it says. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, my counsel to you on this particular point, and I mean this with all seriousness, would be to, I mean, there, part of our Episcopal way of being is to, we have a prayer book and we have rubrics and we have canons and we have things that control these matters, but the interpretation of all of that is left to the local ordinary. And some ordinaries are very strict in their interpretation of these matters. And some of them even have hierarchies of documents. You know, like, I'll give you an example. Well, the prayer book says this. It's a part of the constitution of the church. The canon says something in conflict. Which wins? So it's kind of like, you know, It's you know, kind of like the same sort of political arguments people make. Well, some would say, well, because the prayer book is in the Constitution of the Church, it takes precedence over a canon. Most canon lawyers would say, no, the way that since the Episcopal Church has no judiciary, the only way that you can get an interpretation of a constitutional matter is through the canonical process. So a canon subsequent to the Constitution is an interpretation of the church about what that means. And the bishops are all over the place on that. Some are very strict constitutionalists, some are more canonists, some of them want to make you happy. And all variations there between. But I mean, I've also learned over time, and I don't make light of this, there's a certain wisdom in that. You know, because The diversity in the Episcopal Church is such that we really must depend on our bishops, not only to call us together and to hold us together in some sense of unity around the gospel and the things we cherish, but we also have to trust our bishops to be interpreters of what it means to live the gospel in this particular place. And that's a really different task in inner city Atlanta than it is in the deserts of Nevada. But we have to trust those two bishops to take our inheritance and the materials of our tradition and interpret and cajole and support and whatever, ministry in those very different contexts. So my counsel would be, quite apart from what's going on in the blogosphere and the technicalities of a general convention thing, ask the bishop.
Yeah. Let me do a footnote to that. And this is just a footnote for the Lutherans and for Episcopalians interested in the Lutherans. I said, you're more likely to need to ask your bishop if you're an Episcopalian or talking about Episcopal matters than you are if you're a Lutheran. I want to qualify that a little bit. There's a long tradition in Lutheran churches of the role of the bishop as a visitor. And visitation means coming to see how the gospel is in this parish. And that includes inquiry about, ought to include inquiry about the liturgical practice of the parish. I want to encourage bishops, Lutheran bishops, to recover the old tradition, the old, deeply old Lutheran tradition. Some of the confessional writings of the Lutheran Church began their life as visitation articles. That is to say, lists of concerns, superintendents, as they were sometimes called exercising episcopate in the early German Lutheran churches, or bishops would be concerned about when they visited parishes. I think it's a great legitimate concern, and I really hope to see a renewal of the visitation interest on the part of Lutheran bishops in our time. I think if you're a Lutheran, you might wonderfully shock your bishop by asking your bishop's permission or counsel about a liturgical practice. I think that's a great idea, and I think bishops would respond positively. They would might be first shocked, but I think they would. It's a kind of call to do their vocation, if you will, a call to be engaged in episcopate, and I think it's a great idea. Second footnote I want to make to a couple things that we've said repeatedly. Lutherans have rubrics too, and we've more recently written them in sort of council language because that works better for us. They're still rubrics. If you've never read Aidan Cavanaugh's Elements of Rite, I really urge you to read that little book. It's really it makes me mad as hell every time I read it, but it's mad in good ways. It pushes you. It makes you laugh out loud. You know, at one point he talks about how liturgy is not a monologue inflicted upon the seated, for example, he has a wonderful passage there about what rubrics are. Rubrics for Kavanaugh, as he says, are not ancient tripwires connected to bombs planted by old bishops. Rubrics are like the banks of a stream. They're not the stream, but they're like the banks of a stream that makes the stream possible. If the banks break down, the stream goes everywhere. But banks of streams change, too. A living river is going to be changing the banks of the stream. Or another thing to say about rubrics is they are accumulated wisdom about how we do this. They're the wisdom of generations of people who've done this together. So you don't just ignore the wisdom. But the wisdom is also in the process of changing. And a lively liturgical tradition will be about rubrics changing, like the banks of the stream changing. But the stream is the gospel. The stream is the gospel enacted in word and sacrament. And the banks of the stream are for the sake of that stream. I think Lutheran bishops, too, want to be concerned about the banks of the stream and the clarity and force and life-giving power of the stream itself. The reforms in the Second Vatican Council, in the results of the Second Vatican Council, are of a piece in many ways, as Neil made so clear yesterday or the day before, however long, it's a long haze.
Sometime in recent memory,
right? Are of a piece with the same issues that have been alive in our churches, in Anglican and Lutheran churches. Some of that Vatican II impetus is continuing in Roman Catholic circles and broadening, so that Roman Catholics are finding themselves learning from sources outside of themselves, which is wonderful to see. Wonderful to see. For my money, one of my favorite things that's happened from that result is a reflection in Roman Catholic circles on what they call liturgical ecclesiology. That is to say, the understanding that the church is primarily the assembly that gathers to do the gospel alive in the rites. That Christ is present in that assembly, and not just in the priest. Those that accent on the presence of Christ and on the reality of the church as a gathered assembly, those are accents that a Lutheran finds stunningly wonderful. But liturgical ecclesiology is challenged in Roman Catholic circles, and so are all the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. It's sometimes precarious future. And I have to say, as a as an observer, but not an observer, just also one profoundly affected by what happens in the Roman Catholic Church that affects us all, the recent English-speaking Roman Catholic change of the language of the Mass, which was done top-down, ignoring the work that had been done by many, many people throughout the English-speaking Roman Catholic world toward a reform of the language of the Mass. The recent reform of the language of the Mass on the basis of the Latinist principles, I think is one of the saddest things that's happened recently ecumenically, because it meant that the Roman Catholic Church, English-speaking Roman Catholic Church, abandoned the shared ecumenical text that we had been sharing together with them. That just I weep when I think about it. So that's one comment on I don't know if that's the kind of thing you were looking for, but I really, Massimo Fagioli, Faggioli, is an Italian Roman Catholic teaching in America at a Roman Catholic college, a lay theologian, an amazing ecclesiologist. He writes that the genius of the Second Vatican Council is in the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, and that that's the foundation of everything that the Second Vatican Council did, and that all moves toward a liturgical ecclesiology, which to a Lutheran's ears is music, because it's an argument in accord with the seventh article of the Augsburg Confession. So.
I don't have much to add to that. I quite agree with Gordon's comments on the retrograde of the new translation of the Missal, which is, I think, an utter abandonment of just so much good work and so much progress that has been made. And to say something that Gordon has just said, but to say it slightly differently, but in full agreement. When I'm beginning a class of new students in liturgical studies, one of the points I make right out of the gate is to study the liturgy and to study the church's prayer is to do an exercise in practical ecclesiology. And to pray the liturgy and to be a part of a liturgical community and to be shaped by a church at prayer is to be engaging in a kind of embodied ecclesiology. I'll leave it to others whether it's helpful or not, but I found some years ago as a way to think about this in teaching was to think about a mobile over the bed of a child for the child's entertainment, you know, and one of those little dangles on the mobile is Holy Baptism, and one is Holy Eucharist, and one is ordination, and one is ecclesiology, and one is, I mean, but the point being that when the mobile starts moving, you touch one of them and they all move. You touch the other one and they all move. So if you make a decision about the doctrine of ordinations, then you have made a decision about the Eucharist. And you're likely to have made a decision about holy baptism in some level, direct or indirect, oblique or whatever. And you're surely to have made an ecclesiological decision. By the same token, if you produce a new baptismal rite or whatever, and there are ideas and theologies and living realities of the gospel embodied in that rite and in those prayers, and as a consequence of that, the mobile on laity and ordained life and Eucharist and ecclesiology, those parts of the mobile, ever how gently, are also moving. You can't ever touch one of those without touching all of them. And then as we work with the liturgy, as we pray with the liturgy, as we take two different traditions and judiciously put them together, that mobile is ever so gently, and perhaps as much by the wind of the Spirit as by our own intellect. But it's all gently, you know. I mean, what keeps us employed are things like, you know, in the 7th century, which was the chicken, which was the egg? Was the new trajectory of Eucharistic theology a result of changes in our understanding of priesthood? Or was the trajectory in Eucharistic theology what caused the changes in the priesthood? But my point to my students is always, touch one, you're going to touch them all. And maybe it's less causal than it is organic. Yeah, sure. Right back here.
Question on music and its role in the service. If I look at a bulletin board outside the Episcopal Church, I'll know whether you're having rite one or rite two. If I go to the Lutheran Church, is it going to tell me whether it's organ-based, traditional-based music, or contemporary praise band, whatever? What role does the music play? And is there a difference between the music support in a Eucharistic service over against the service of the Word?
That's for you.
Okay.
The bell is a bell, as I said, and at least in Lutheran circles, the liturgy is sung. I've loved it that a recent development in Lutheran circles is to call the principal musician in the congregation the leader of assembly song. That the major role of the musician in the assembly is to help the assembly sing, and the choir is the rehearsed voices of the assembly, whose first task is to support the assembly song. And sometimes to sing the harder parts, the parts that need rehearsal. But all of that then this is not a performance occasion. All of that is the assembly in song around word and sacrament in flow, if you will. The event is a word and sacrament flowing event. One thing next to another, meaning the whole thing. And that flow is a musical flow. I suppose my biggest sorrow about what has gotten called contemporary worship in Lutheran circles is an abandonment of several of those principles. The praise band becomes seriously a performing group. In fact, it frequently takes over the center of the room, or takes over the eyes of the people because it dominates by some kind of screen mechanism or something. And it isn't singing through the flow of word and sacrament, or assisting the people to sing through the flow of word and sacrament. Contemporary worship is, that title is used for a lot of things. In some congregations, what it means is doing things slightly differently than you used to do them. And that's mostly, I just wish we would abandon the distinction between traditional and contemporary. Frequently, it's based upon some older people's ideas of what young people like. And it's usually a wrong idea. And while I don't usually use the word blended, I think a much better idea is to think about how music in the liturgical life of the church is going to be a blended phenomenon. In Lutheran circles, it has been that from the beginning. That is to say, in Lutheran circles, there's always been chant and chorale. At least two kinds of music, frequently side by side, enabling the flow of the event. Like there's always pairs, more than one thing. There's a wonderful Lutheran theologian that said, in this world, in order to say the truth about God, we always need at least two words, never just one. And that two words includes word and sacrament, includes more than one reading. It includes bread and wine, includes more than one kind of music. But for me, music in the assembly is the way we move through the flow of one thing next to another, meaning Jesus Christ as another two things, Jesus Christ, meaning Jesus Christ for the life of the world. That's a beginning. There's lots more to say about music in the assembly. I am extraordinarily proud of the ELW figuring out how to have 10 settings for the liturgy and a whole bunch of service music beside. I just learned this morning that there's a setting 11 published by Lutheran Forum people that's a bluegrass, Deutsche Messe, if you will, that belongs in the Shenandoah Valley, and I think that's wonderful. That's profoundly Lutheran thing to do. But that's not contemporary worship. That's enabling the congregation to sing, to do its work. The liturgy is what the assembly is doing, and the presider is presiding in the midst of the assembly's work, and the musician is the leader of assembly song. Yeah, that's good. Please, Bishop.
I have a big question, a question on my heart. A question that I think is terribly important is what I know is the Episcopalian of Dietrich Bonhoeffer is so much of who he was formed liturgically. In community, in prayer, in his deep understanding of the Eucharist in community as a former, as formation for standing for the gospel. We talked a lot about technicalities and liturgical differences in what bishops allow. We talked about liturgies and technicalities and what bishops would allow, and I think, frankly, bishops allow a lot, in my experience. What I'd really like to think of is we've got a room full of pastors and priests who are custodians of the gospel in the now of American life. And what did the two of you think about how liturgy and church is shaping us as a non-Roman Catholic, but Catholic church committed to the gospel, but yet needing to be a church of witness in the United States of America today? How is liturgy getting us ready for that?
Well, that's a huge question, of course, and it's wonderful.
I bet you thought about
that. To say the least. I think because we think what we mean by liturgy is the practice of the means of grace in an assembly, and the means of grace are practiced for the sake of the clarity of the gospel, and the gospel is Jesus Christ for the life of the world, we are constantly asking, how does assembly practice shape our life? There are certainly moments when I'm going to come at that more disappointed, and disappointment frequently leads to cynicism, to think, you know, it doesn't have any effect at all. the engagement with the world or the care about others seems to be no greater in our congregation than it is in an assembly of other people that never darken the door of a church. Mostly I get past that cynicism, and get back to the idea that the renewal of hope, the possibility of living not out of fear. I mean, and a major thing in North America right now is that our decisions all get made out of fear. We're about to make decisions in the national election, which I'm afraid are going to be made out of fear for too many people. And there are politicians pandering to that fear. I think the gospel is an invitation to not live out of fear, but to live out of the promise of God in spite of any evidence. And the point about the liturgy is to make, to pour the gospel over us, to stuff it in our ears, to put it in our heart, to give it to us to eat and drink, to bond us to our neighbor by the gospel celebrated. So, I mean, I could go on about that, but okay. Well, this was just to give Neil time to think about a better answer.
No, there is no better answer. That is the answer. I do think that, but I want to say, I really do understand Gordon's comment about cynicism. But I also want to say that I am at this moment, despite the enormous challenges of our churches, I am a more hopeful pastor today, a more hopeful believer today, a more encouraged disciple of Jesus today than I have ever been. And that is not about me. That is about what I see going on in our churches. And it's particularly what I see in terms of the commitment and the discipleship and the devotion to the tradition, to the great tradition. I don't mean to Anglicanism or to Lutheranism. I'm talking about to the great tradition of people in round numbers under 40. One of the joys of I'm the dean of a seminary that for much of the last, say, 50 years has been thought of as the second career seminary of the Episcopal Church. And now 80% of our students are under 30, and nearly all of those are under 25. And they are devoted, they are committed, they love not only Jesus and the gospel, but they love the tradition. They love their inheritance. They are tired of being, you know, horsewhipped by the baby boomers about what's important. And by the generation that where basically nothing is important except being entertained. And they're not interested in being entertained. I mean, they're entertained to death. They are so connected that they look for opportunities to disconnect. You know, it is such a joy to see this transformation going on. And so I am more hopeful than I've ever been. The greatest obstacle to that is the leadership of the church, the structures of the church, the organization of the church, freeing and empowering a new generation of leadership rather than restricting them because they don't want to do it the way we want it to do it. The other piece of that that I believe I'm seeing, I hope I'm seeing, I hope this is not just fantasy, but I will say that my generation, baby boomer generation, my generation of leaders in the church, I think we were pretty good at certain things. We were pretty good pastors. We were respectable preachers. We did interesting work with congregations. It wasn't that we were total failures. But the one place where we failed big time as a generation of clergy is that very few of us would have given any time or energy into being rabbis. We would pastor people, we would administer congregations, we would do other kinds of things, all of which probably needed to be done. And it's not that any of them are unimportant. I'm not downplaying any of the wonderful work that has been done. But I am prepared to say that part of the weakness of the church's mission in certain contexts is we've had a generation, and the seminaries, and believe me, I was a part of them, so this is a self-indictment. The seminaries have taught us to do everything well except be rabbis. Teaching the scripture, teaching the life of faith, teaching a moral vision, teaching a biblically based, gospel based notion of God's justice at work in the world. I mean, we there are obviously notable exceptions, maybe, but taken as a group, I think where my generation of clergy failed and where the seminaries failed us in that period is we've done everything with our people, and we've been enormously important in all kinds of interesting ways, and that's all fine and good, but where we have failed them is we have not been good teachers. We have not fully talked about and passed on the riches of the tradition and the scriptures and so forth. And what gives me hope, though, is sitting where I do as the dean of a seminary, there's a new crop coming in, and they are much more interested in the rabbinical side of ministry than they are some of the stuff that we did. And I think that's good news for the church. So.
That's great, Neil. I love what you say. I would just add in the definition of rabbis that I hope that also means what a scholar and curator of the tradition. That is to say, parish pastors who read and read the past as well as the present and think about it and keep learning and do the teaching out of that continued curating and maintenance of the tradition. So, please. Okay.
In your talk, you intimated that the Episcopal Church has of late been something less than a careful steward of liturgical language.
Yes.
And I wondered if you might give an example or two, and then I'd like to hear what you have.
Yeah. I say this with love and care, and I'm very grateful that Catherine reminded us of the terms of the formula of agreement between the ELCA and several Reformed churches that call for, in language borrowed from agreements in Germany, call for mutual affirmation and admonition. So there was lots of affirmation in that affirmation of the Episcopal Church as the Anglican tradition generally as the caretaker of a lively liturgical tradition in English, and there was some admonition in that you've let it drop, but I understand you've had other things to do. Here's what I'd say is, when I pick up the Lutheran Book of Worship now, I am aware of a linguistic gap. I couldn't really use the Lutheran Book of Worship anymore. That's interesting. That's a book from the late 70s. That's because of its inattention, its inability to have attention to a lively, inclusive language. There's a way to do inclusive language that's faithful, alive, biblical, and I'm proud of the ELW, having tried to undertake that in several ways. The prayer book is, in fact, an old book now in how it feels. It's not the language. And now that's even right two, let alone right one. I have to say that you still have right one. I just simply don't understand. It's a beautiful museum piece. It is not living worship in the present time in North America. And I know people think that that's what worship is to articulate essentially a Jacobean language. I think that's wrong. And I think the Episcopal Church needs to work on that. Okay, is that? Okay. So the Psalter, but it's not just the Psalter. It's everything. And the point is, it's not, I don't just mean inclusive language. I mean biblically, metaphorically rich language. The Eucharistic prayers in the prayer book are doctrinally correct and metaphorically poor. And the Bible is metaphorically rich. That's okay.
I don't have any fundamental disagreement with that. I think it's but I don't think the fact that we've been busy with other things is a worthy excuse. What I do think is perhaps not a worthy excuse, but a worthy reality to note is that very, very early after the appearance of the prayer book, we started struggling with the issue of inclusive language. In the early 1980s, the prayer book, the ink hadn't even dried, and we began to put out inclusive language rites, expansive language rites, alternative prayers, whatever, you know, and that created a tidal wave of reactivity, and I don't think that was a matter of lack of concern. I think it was poor strategy, and we needed to rethink some of the way that got done. And then over the years, as those alternatives have developed and in some cases improved, in some cases not, I think that's, but I think after that early reactivity, when that was tested so quickly after the appearance of the book, I mean, I'm sure that ELW is not finished, but part of the discernment and wisdom of the church will be when to start talking and when to start thinking about what needs to come next. And I think where some of these language issues for us just really failed is we saw the need for that almost immediately and jumped into that too quickly, and as a result created more of a barrier than a helpful movement into that conversation. That said, as we think about prayer book revision, I don't have any doubt that, not for one second, that the language, a richer, more metaphorical, more inclusive kind of language will be very much a part of the conversation and very much on the table. I will say excellent work on the ELW, because I actually believe the English in ELW has a kind of elegance about it. When I've used it and when I've been to Lutheran services and when I've just, being a liturgical scholar, I spend a lot of time with it in my lap, just getting familiar with it. And even in those prayers that I'm very familiar with and have memorized, and there's been adaptations to them, the adaptation's a little, at the beginning, but then you look at it and you think about it and that actually is good. That's okay. What worries me, at one level is, I do think that for its time, the elegance of Rite II in the Rite II liturgies of the 1979 prayer book was a stunning achievement.
Amen.
And it is old now, and it does need to be revised. I have no argument there. My greatest fear going forward is will we be able to rally around some very clear principles of how this needs to be done and create a new liturgical language that is every bit for this age as elegant and as beautiful and so forth. And the reason that worries me is because if you pick up a copy of Common Worship from the Church of England, sorry if this sounds judgmental, I think, the custodians of the King's English have failed. It is by and large, I think, it's just flat. And it is common. There is no doubt about that in that sense. And while I quite agree, I don't have any need to talk to God in Elizabethan English. Maybe Elizabeth II, but certainly not Elizabeth I. I do think we have a responsibility to create the most beautiful liturgical language and language of prayer possible. I think Gordon would agree with me. One of the things that makes me so sad about the current Roman documents is that, you know, the very first English translations that came out were also pretty flat. But over the last 3 or 4 decades, whatever it's been, you know, they've worked on them and refined them and enriched them and by the time, you know, they started out pretty plain and became beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and now somebody says, well, that's just too beautiful, so let's just, you know, so I take the challenge that Gordon is laying out, and I think he's exactly right. I do worry a little bit about how we're going to get there at this point. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the way those materials are put together were to be, you know, supplementary materials. They're not whole rites. And so consequently, I think there are some of the Eucharistic prayers that are really quite beautiful. There are others that are not there yet, wherever there is. And I think some of the biblical canticles and other things that have been added are really quite beautiful enrichments. Some of those translations and some of the language of the biblical canticles, I think, could be gone over again and made somewhat more beautiful without damaging any of the intent. And so my sense of those materials is that there are prayers and collects and litanies and canticles and things that are genuine enrichments, and I'm glad we have them, and I wish we would use them more. There are others that are there that I don't suspect will make it into a revision. Other ones I think will probably. But you know, under the rubric of judicious use, I think one ought to at least, you know, look at them and have them at arm's length and figure out at what time with your own local assembly this could be a really fine enrichment. And then let the liturgical commission know what's working and what's not. Yes, ma'am.
You both alluded, though this is mostly on liturgy, but you both alluded to church polity. The mobile touches everything. Check the bishop if you're in an Episcopal congregation. Can you comment briefly on what some of those minefields might be for people crossing from either Episcopal into Lutheran or Lutheran into Episcopal relative to church polity, local church government polity?
I think probably most of the minefields will be those who are Lutherans are coming to the Episcopal Church. And that is because, and Gordon was very eloquent about this the other day. You know, we have, the Lutheran Church clearly has a church constitution. It has documents that guide its life. And of course, there are the confessions. And so it's not like you're rudderless. I mean, their policies, procedures, their ways, agreed upon ways we do things, right? There is all that. I suppose one could argue in some sort of way that whereas those policies and procedures and guides and our common way of living together as Lutherans, the ante gets raised somewhat in the Episcopal Church because many of those very same things are addressed, but we address them canonically, where the stakes of obedience and following the canon of the church is perhaps a little higher. And so one could imagine falling into to that pretty quickly. However, I would really want to say very quickly that as people go back and forth, that's probably not an area we need to worry about a lot. That there's a minefield there, that there's a pothole here or there, that, you know, somebody might have to help you through a moment of something is probably true. But, you know, at its best, canon law is not there to be limiting. It is there to enable the life of the church in its fullness by creating the banks of the river, to use that image again. And the canons are not to be feared in some negative way or seen as some block to something, but as our agreed upon way to live together that is constantly, you know, in flux. You know, I still say to students and to the new members of the House of Bishops and whatever in my class, you know, when you're working, whether it's through conflict or you're working through a difficult decision or you're working whatever, you know, when you get to the point in that conversation where you have to resort to the canons, you've lost the argument. That we ought to be able to do these things, but I don't conceive of the canons as a negative thing. I really do think that they can be gifts to us to do that. But in no case are they to be feared. I just think it's there are differences in our polity. I remember when we were doing joint work with the Southeastern Synod in campus ministry when I was the Bishop of Atlanta. One of the things that was really interesting one day, this was the time when Ron Warren was the bishop of the Eastern Synod, Southeastern Synod, one bishop ago, and we were going to appoint this joint commission to really ferret out campus ministry in the Southeast and whatever, and I said, well, how are we, let me know when you get your folks together and we'll get this organized. And he said, well, this is not going to happen immediately. I said, oh. He said, yeah, well, I'll have to, you know, talk to this body and get their nominations and this body and get their nominations and Senate Council will have to approve the list and be blah, 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 blah. And that'll take like 3 months or something, you know. And I said, okay, fine. He said, well, how long is it going to take you? And I said, oh, 5 minutes. Because, you know, it's the bishop. I just appoint those people, you know. And I'll probably report that appointment to the Senate Council, I mean, to the diocesan councils. Like, by the way, I appointed these people to this commission. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You know, but again, I mean, it's just, and that's not a criticism of either side. That's just to say, this is just a difference in the way we do work. You know, you have some ways to do it, and we have some ways to do it, and there it is. So,
it's a great question. Let me simple answer. If you're coming to a Lutheran, to the Lutheran side and Episcopalian, you're going to want to make sure, I mean, this is wisdom for anybody coming to any congregation, you want to make sure you pay attention to the history of that congregation and the deep memories in that congregation. That congregation's liturgical life is the congregation's liturgical life, and you need to respect that and pay attention to it. And you're going to need to make changes, if you make them, only after you've listened and listened and listened, and then by teaching and love. And a bishop who is going to be observing you, or a dean of a local cluster of congregations, is gonna in a Lutheran church be interested in whether or not you've listened, whether you care about the people, and whether or not you're attending to the gospel in that place. The Lutheran concern is going to be primarily whether or not the gospel is clear. That's at least theoretically what our bishops are interested in questions of visitation. Theoretically, I want to encourage them to do that. But then I'd say, read the use of the means of grace. It matters in the ELCA. It's not canons, but read it, know it. That's counsel to people who've been Lutheran pastors too. That's a document from 97. It needs to be reread and restudied again. I urge you to do that. If you're an Episcopalian or a Lutheran, for that matter, you can find it online. You can also find it printed in the appendix of the first of the handbooks for the use of the ELW, the handbook that's called the Sunday Assembly. Both the Canadian and the ELCA statement on sacramental or means of grace practice is in the back of that book. Then I would say that synods differ like congregations differ. There's certainly constitutional structures that are going to be very similar, but how the synod functions, pay attention. You know, the synod assembly will be a place you learn that. So will be local cluster meetings. So we'll just be listening to your fellow pastors. I don't know. Does that other Lutherans? Is that an adequate answer about where to watch for pitfalls? And Richard, do you want to say something to that? Love it. Lovely.
I know that that's different in some sense. My sense is very small and compact, and the office is in the midst of all these lovely restaurants.
Yeah.
But if you want to make contact, then come and visit.
I think that's very good.
The other thing is that people do call me up and say, and this is Lutheran pastors too, do call me up and say, I'm thinking about trying this in the liturgy in a couple of weeks. What do you think of that?
Excellent. Great.
Because the networking of experimentation is really interesting in this. Again, the smaller situation I'm
talking
about. But it is still, everything's a matter of context, but everything's a matter of relationship, too.
So excellent.
Just the opportunity to make the relationship.
Excellent. Yeah, I think you probably will have heard in both of our responses that in Lutheran circles, relationships do matter. So. Great. Okay, you go ahead. Yeah.
I want to underline what you've heard a couple of times this morning, that people who are working in these situations, on the one hand, have to worry about the mind, the guilt, and the rules, and the pitfalls. But please think of yourselves as people who are helping the church to learn. And so you have things to offer and to share and to communicate, as well as
excellent.
Things to worry about.
And I think one of the things Gordon said that is so important it's such a reality in the Episcopal Church too, whatever the patina may look like. And that is, as congregations have different histories, dioceses have different histories and different cultures. We may have a common set of church-wide canons that get worked out at some level in diocesan canons, but one of the testimonies of the fact that the Holy Spirit is alive and well in the church, I think is how different Episcopal dioceses are, and how the witness of the Holy Spirit is. I always marvel in the House of Bishops, and I think Ted would agree with me on this. Our dioceses are really different, with really different stories. Really different cultures as dioceses. And I marvel at how well the people of God do at choosing a bishop. because most of our bishops are very well matched with the diocese they serve. But most of those bishops would also tell you, you know, I used to talk a lot with the Bishop of West Tennessee, which is basically Memphis. And he would say, Neil, I look at your website, I look at the stuff you're doing. And he said, I could no more do what you do than I could fly the moon. And at the same time, I would look at what's going on in the Diocese of West Tennessee. And I don't mean this with anything but love and respect. But if I had to be the Bishop of West Tennessee, just shoot me. I mean, there's just nothing about that ministry that I could do. I mean, I would be sacrificing my life for Jesus in a way that I don't think Jesus wants me to do that, you know? And yet he has given that diocese, he has been the instrument of the gospel for new life and for vigor and for growth and for health. And it's been an incredible story of raising up an ever stronger church. I couldn't have done that, you know. And so we really are different. You go to one place and say, well, you know, you're not following Canon 6. And you go to the next diocese over and the bishop says, what's Canon 6?
I think we should take 10 minutes here at the end to do a thing that Neil and I both wanted to do. And then we can be done and take a 15-minute break and go to Eucharist. Neil and I thought we should maybe each say something about trajectories toward the future. What's next? I tell you, if I thought I was facing yet another process to create another book, I would be nervous too. I think the ELW is got another couple decades in it, maybe more than that. I think that the Lutheran churches in North America are going to need to face the question of what comes after the ELW sometime. But right now, the real question for us is making use of the ELW. And there is a move afoot from ELCA churchwide headquarters to sponsor a series of workshops around the church on further education into the use of the ELW. We had those workshops a long time ago with the LBW, and they were one of the most important things that ever happened in the Lutheran churches in North America. They're coming again. Watch for them. Get involved with them. I think they will be excellent. But as we live into the ELW, let me say one more thing about what's beyond the ELW. Probably we will need to face, to the extent to which materials will continue to be both print and online materials, and that's already happened a great deal. Will happen probably even more. And in that process, we will need to face the extent to which our materials are available for doing Lutheran liturgy, but are ecumenically porous, are really worked out with full communion partners as well. That's going to be in our future, too. But I want to say one other thing, and that is about where we're going, what's next. There's a series of challenges that was laid down by Maxwell Johnson, who is a Lutheran professor at the University of Notre Dame, and really a fine Lutheran liturgical scholar, in a book called The Church in Act, which is a collection of essays on Lutheran liturgical theology, and it's really, really a fine book. If you want to see a very recent reflection on Lutheran liturgical life in North America from a theological point of view, look at Maxwell Johnson's The Church in Act. You get from that title, by the way, an idea about liturgical ecclesiology, if you will. But Johnson, at one place in that book, lays out a series of challenges to Lutherans in North America that still lie before us, even though we have this really wonderful resource or family of resources that surround the the LW. Those challenges that Johnson lays out are these. We need to keep working toward Eucharist on Sunday every Sunday. That's not been achieved yet in all of our congregations. It will not be achieved by canon among us. It will be achieved by teaching and love. But the norm of our practice is that Sunday is the principal feast, as Neil has already said, and that the way we celebrate that principal feast is by the full service of word and sacrament. We need to make a fuller use of water, bread, and wine. That speaks for itself. No more dry cleaning. No more fonts with dead flies in them. Really thinking about whether there's any future to those wafers. You've had confirmation students probably who've said to you what they used to say to me. It's easier for me to believe the bread is the body of Christ than to believe that is bread. So a fuller use of water, bread, and wine. We need to abandon the regular use of only the verba. That is to say, we need to claim this remarkable, burgeoning, beautiful collection of Eucharistic prayers. This is Max Johnson, not me. I simply agree with his challenges. We need to, in fact, do the 3 days. Not just have it in our book, but do them. They are life-changing. If you don't know them yet, go to a neighboring parish to see what the vigil is. And partner with other parishes. Maybe partner with an Episcopal parish to do at least the vigil, maybe all three of the 3 days. We need to abandon the distinction between contemporary and traditional worship. If it's faithful worship, it's contemporary. It's about Christ now. And if it's faithful worship, it's traditional. That is to say, it's receiving the faithfully receiving the tradition. We need to abandon that distinction and abandon its distinction in how we shape worship as a kind of market tool. That's what we've done. That's what it's been, a marketing tool. And that's not a faithful way to act. We need to stop using self-constructed statements of faith. That is to say, we need to use the creeds. That's from some experience that Max Johnson has had. And we need to make full use of the lectionary. You've heard from me my sadness and sometimes even edge of anger about some seminary professors in this country who have introduced a alternate lectionary based upon the idea that there's a single big biblical narrative that the people should learn. My problem with that is it's abandoning one of the major ecumenical achievements of the 20th and 21st century. It's and leading your people away from that shared ecumenical gift. It's dealing with the biblical story as if it's a single narrative, when it's not a single narrative. It's a polyphony of narratives. And it's using the Sunday morning event as if it's an educational event rather than the people of God gathered around Christ in word and sacrament. Those are pretty serious challenges. And I really urge you, if the so-called narrative lectionary is on your table, to take those challenges seriously. And at least to yourself, give yourself answers to what you say about those challenges. I think those are actually... there's a few more in Max's book. I urge you to look at Max's book. I think those are really interesting challenges to us, and I take them seriously. But with Neil, I say, for me, it's a stunningly hopeful time. And let me come back to where I began, and that is I really, really, really hope that what you heard from me in this time was at the deepest level. And if there's nothing else you remember, I hope it's this. my deep thanks to you for what you're doing. The Church in Act, Maxwell Johnson.
First, I can't wait to get back to my computer and order Max's book. Max is a friend of mine, and I know him well, and this is one of his many books that somehow I have missed. But at least as Gordon has presented it here, it would do well for the Episcopalians to read it. While we may have a few little tweaks to do, it does sound like an agenda that is worth thinking through really quite clearly. As you know, where we are in the Episcopal Church right now is the 2018 convention. The Standing Liturgical Commission is to bring to the convention for approval a plan for prayer book revision, and I'm assuming that will mean what principles they are recommending, and then the convention will do with that what it wants to and amend them, change them, whatever. But put in motion a process that will examine, study, and eventually create the Book of Common Prayer of some year or not. One of the things I suspect will be debated is whether we will leave the prayer book alone, but raise the stakes significantly on complementary volumes. I would not personally think positively toward that option, because I think unless you change, revise, and update the core book, you will not have done the work that needs to be done. I mean, you can add to it until Jesus comes, but until the book itself has been renovated, you will have not done the work at the fullest level. I think one of the other questions around that will be, are we talking about a new book, or are we talking about the Book of Common Prayer 1979.2? And I don't mean to be flippant about that, but I do think that that probably will get into the mix somewhere, which is to say that after 35 years or 40 years, whatever it is, of pastoral use, 40 years, I guess, of pastoral use, there are things in the prayer book that are in great need of reform. There are other parts of the prayer book that still, even to this day, wear fairly well. And the fear factor around the improvement may be a cause for more alarm than whatever good might come out of it. The other part of it is the prayer book represents, and Gordon mentioned this with respect to confirmation. I mentioned it in respect to the ordinal. There are some other ones that could be named as well. The marriage rites, obviously, where the reforms or the renewal represented by the 1979 prayer book were very significant, but unfinished. We got as far as we could get in 1976, but part of the conversation for us will need to be. Do we want to pick up some of those things in the spirit of finishing that agenda? Or has the agenda actually changed? And which is which, and what applies where, you know? This will be a fairly nuanced conversation in the next 3 to 4 years as this plan comes together. This particular prayer book is the most wholesale revision in the history of the Anglican tradition, where there's more completely new material, complete new thinking, complete reorientation, even though some of the texts and materials that are so familiar to Anglicans are still there. It is far and away the most wholesale revision in the history of our tradition. And so, just to put it really baldly, is the church in a position right now that it might be willing to do something else that looks fairly dramatically wholesale? Or I think there'll be wide agreement in the church, and certainly at the convention, that in an official way this whole liturgical thing has got to move forward. I don't think there's going to be much pushback about that. It will be an argument of are we going all the way wholesale, or are we going to take the riches that are there and try to make improvements in language and in options and in a variety of things, or are we going to pull back and really think in that sort of wholesale way that we did between about 1963 and 1976. The other thing that makes this an interesting question for me is that in my presentation yesterday, you know, I talked about what was essentially a century of fermentation between Lutherans, Anglicans, and Roman Catholics in particular, and also some of our other ecclesial brethren and sisters. But there was a century of ferment that kept sort of urging us in this direction. There has continued to be conversation, more learning, more pastoral practice, more, you know, but I'm not at all arguing that there's not fermentation, new insight, new movements of the Spirit in all these areas. Not at all. Not at all. We have learned so much since the appearance of the books in the late 70s, as witnessed by the ELW. But it's a slightly different kind of learning. Because the consensus around certain kinds of concepts of ordo and baptismal ecclesiology and centrality of the Eucharist and the primacy of Sunday and those kinds of things that we were first beginning to manifest in LBW and the BCP, some of those fundamental commitments have not changed. We know a little bit more. We have some things, you know, they've not changed in the sense that they changed between, you know, 1888 and 1892 and the LBW and the BCP. I mean, that was the consensus that emerged in that century was so much more dramatic than any change in those fundamental principles from then to now. So that's going to be an interesting thing to think through and to work through. I think the Lutherans have done it with style and grace, and it now becomes the Episcopal Church's burden to figure out what our particular version of that might look like.
I want to thank Neil for the gift of being able to stand side by side with him in this amazing opportunity to respond to you and to be in your midst. So, thank you.